Today is Thursday, September 21st. We're going to wrap up heart inflammation and begin blood vessels today. Okay, so on page 45, we're going to talk about what increases versus what decreases heart rate. On Tuesday, we already talked about what increases heart rate. Can you tell me a couple of neurotransmitters that will increase your heart rate?
Epinephrine,
norepinephrine. How about some hormones that will increase your heart rate?
Thyroxine.
Glucagon. Good. What about body temperature? Hot or cold?
Hot.
Hot will increase your body, you know, your heart rate. Fever, of course, will do a good job for that. And then other things like caffeine, we know that will increase heart rate. One of our favorite stimulant drugs is caffeine for speeding up heart rate. Let's kind of look at the other side of the coin. Let's talk about some things that will decrease your heart rate. Let's talk about the parasympathetic nervous system and its role in basically lowering heart rate and slowing it down. By the way, this is the dominant system for the heart. It works with acetylcholine, and it's normally going to reduce your heart rate, and it wants to be the system in control over the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so the vagus nerve is the one that travels from the brain through the chest cavity, even goes down so far as your bladder. And when it releases acetylcholine on the heart, what does it tell your SA node to do?
Fire
more quickly or more slowly?
Slowly.
Slower, yeah. So it slows down heart rate. You'll notice on your sheet there's something called vagal tone or nerve tone. This kind of vagal nerve tone is what normally keeps the heart at a normal, slower resting rate. In those athletes who are well-toned and well-exercised, like an Olympian, the resting heart rate may naturally be in the 30s, simply because the heart is a muscular, well-toned, pumping organ. And the parasympathetic nervous system is responsible for that lower resting heart rate. Okay, so if you happen to have an overactive vagus nerve, there is a medication called atropine that can help to raise your heart rate. You know, a lot of people take medications to lower their heart rate and blood pressure, but this happens to be one that will actually increase your heart rate, atropine. Let's talk about vasovagal syncope or syncope. This is just fancy language for what?
Fainting,
right. So in this instance, what is the vagus nerve doing?
Dropping the heart rate,
yep. Overstimulating, right. So if you are, you know, sleepy and tired after a meal, you know, that kind of thing, you ever get sleepy and tired right after a meal, you feel like you need to go have a nap?
It's called the itis?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be called itis.
Gotta go have a nap.
Yes.
Yep. So that's the vagus nerve at work. That's parasympathetic nervous system dominating. So we know that if in extreme cases, overstimulation of the vagus nerve can make us pass out. You know, just want to go back and reiterate, if you have someone in a nursing home who takes heart rate medication in the first place that lowers the heart rate, then this person sits in the toilet and strains to have a bowel movement, that just doubles the effects of lowering the heart rate. So what might happen to this person sitting on the toilet?
Pass out,
exactly. So, what's that?
Elvis,
yes. Holding your breath, coughing, bearing down as if you're going to have a bowel movement, all of these activities can stimulate the vagus nerve and put it in control. Likewise, dunking your face in a bowl of ice-cold water can also stimulate the vagus nerve. You know, sometimes when people jump in a swimming pool and it's really cold, they say, wow, that took my breath away. That's kind of the whole concept here. The vagus nerve will lower the heart rate in all of these situations. So pretty powerful nerve as to what it can do to our heart rate. So what we're talking about in terms of holding your breath, bearing down to have a bowel movement, or making a really deep, hearty cough, these are called the vagal maneuver, or otherwise known as the Valsalva maneuver. So, you know, whether or not you realize that every time you bend over to pick up something, you're going to end up holding your breath, and that stimulates the vagus nerve to release which neurotransmitter?
Acetylcholine,
and your heart rate will decrease. Hey, if your heart rate decreases, what happens to your cardiac output? It goes lower too, right. And getting a little ahead of ourselves, if you decrease cardiac output, do you know what happens to blood pressure? It drops too. So there it goes, right? There goes your heart rate, your blood pressure when we have the vagal syncope or when we have the Valsalva's maneuver.
So is that why whenever, like, after you do that and you stay back up, your heart sort of breaks things?
Yes.
Really fast?
It's that compensation, yeah, sure. And if you stand up too quickly, you feel like you're going to pass out. Yeah.
Done.
So I know you guys probably remember the vagus nerve. It is an unusual one because it does travel from the cranial area, the brain, down to the thoracic and abdominal pelvic cavities. That's not really something any other cranial nerve pair does. You know, it's unique in that feature. But we do know it's part of that parasympathetic nervous system rest and digest pathway. So we're not done talking about the vagus nerve. It's going to play a role in the digestive system. Of course, it's got a big role there in promoting digestion. So we'll come back and talk about this one more time in a couple of chapters. Let's see. We've got some ions that will also decrease heart rate. Let's see. We've got calcium levels there that can influence heart rhythms. So if you happen to have low blood calcium or hypocalcemia, that can cause your heart to beat more slowly with less strength. And so, thinking big picture here, can you tell me two hormones that regulate blood calcium levels? Yeah, PTH and calcitonin. And if you happen to have low blood calcium levels, which one of these may not be doing its job in raising blood calcium? PTH, parathyroid, good. So in adults, we know that parathyroid is more likely the controller of blood calcium. We tend to see calcitonin most active in kids. So for an adult to have a calcium regulation issue, we're probably going to point the finger at PTH. Let's see, probably even more dangerous is potassium levels. And you'll notice here that high levels of potassium, known as hyperkalemia, can cause fatal heart arrhythmias. So what happens is we can reset the resting state for your muscle cells and the heart to a hyperpolarized state. What happens to any muscle cell that hyperpolarizes? Can you conduct an action potential? No. So unfortunately, if you hyperpolarize with excess potassium, those muscle cells and the heart tend to stay at rest. So to kind of give this, you know, a big picture feel, when animals are put to sleep, you know, euthanasia, they actually are given a solution of potassium chloride. So that excess potassium is what stops the heart, and then they may be given an anesthetic that allows them to not feel anything. But yeah, potassium levels can be a real dangerous thing. Thinking back, which hormone regulates potassium levels?
Aldosterone,
good. And I want to throw something out. Insulin also plays a role with potassium. Okay, so insulin, we're going to kind of keep that in the back of our minds, does have an influence over potassium. All right, down at the bottom of your page, I just wanted to mention beta blockers, alpha blockers, calcium channel blockers. We talked in class on Tuesday about beta blockers. These specifically block what neurotransmitters?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine. And since those neurotransmitters raise your heart rate, what impact will a beta blocker have on your heart rate?
Lowers it,
right. And so, just to kind of take this the next step, if you lower heart rate, what happens to your cardiac output?
Lowers
it. And of course, your blood pressure does the same. It also decreases. Alpha blockers block alpha receptors, just as a beta blocker will block a beta receptor. So alpha blockers are also used to lower heart rate, as are calcium channel blockers. Now, the name calcium channel blocker is pretty descriptive. Would you give this calcium channel blocker to a person with high blood calcium or low blood calcium?
High
blood calcium, yeah. And if you are administering this to a person with high blood calcium, what are you trying to do to their heart rate?
Slow it down.
Slow it down, yeah. So what impact does calcium have on heart rate? The more calcium you've got, the stronger and the faster your heart will beat. And so a calcium channel blocker can decrease the rate and the strength of contraction. So it has kind of a double job there.
So is it obvious, like, which medication someone would need to be on? Like, what tests do you have to be on?
So initially, it may not be obvious. Initially, like, for me, I had I have SVT, and I had a fast heart rate of 95 beats per minute. And so they look at your blood test, and if your calcium levels are okay, then you don't need a calcium channel blocker. How you respond, like I was put on a stress test and my heart rate jumped like in 15 seconds, then they're looking at, okay, that's probably more of a beta blocker issue.
So the stress test.
Stress test, yeah. That and a blood test will help them eliminate one by another till they eventually figure out which one would be best for a person. Yeah. Okay, so that should cover page 45. I hope you see that page and the previous information on 44 kind of goes hand in hand with preload and contractility and afterload. Just a little bit left here in this particular chapter. Let's talk about cardiac problems. This comes from pages 46 and 47. Chronic heart failure is also known as congestive heart failure. We can call it CHF for short. And this condition can be caused by coronary atherosclerosis. What in the world does that mean? Yeah, clogging of the coronary arteries, right. And unfortunately, when vessels get clogged, your body says, ooh, this is not supposed to be here, walls it off with a layer of calcium. And over time, those walls of calcium become hardened. Therefore, the vessels are no longer able to relax or constrict like they're supposed to. So you are not able to regulate blood pressure to the heart as you once were. All right, so then we've got high blood pressure, which can also come from clogging of our systemic vessels. Same story. If you let, say, plaques of cholesterol clog up your vessels, your body says, ooh, this is not supposed to be here. Inflammation can result, and we wall it off with a layer of calcium. And over time, that can cause our vessel diameters to narrow and our blood pressure to increase. What is the problem with heart attacks and cardiac muscle tissue? Yeah, damages it, turns that muscle tissue to scar tissue. And scar tissue is mostly what fiber type? Collagen. Yep. Collagen. So it doesn't stretch like muscle tissue. It doesn't contract like muscle tissue. Therefore, any part of your heart that is now occupied by scar tissue is not going to contract and work like the heart should. So there's an issue for pumping accurately. And over time, if your heart is having to work harder to pump blood through smaller, tighter vessels, your heart will become big and flabby. And we call this dilated cardiomyopathy. Basically, this means an enlargement of the heart. And if your heart is big and flabby and unable to do its job as a pump, then it just works harder to do its job better. And over years of time, your heart continues to enlarge in order to pump blood out to your body's cells and tissues. So this is actually a great example of a positive feedback mechanism. You know, we don't have a whole lot of those to discuss. So let me pull up this YouTube video so we can see how the heart responds. It's not going to work. Hold on one second. Chronic heart failure is positive feedback. Oops. Go back to that link one more time. Okay, so we'll just let this run without Sam because I think you get the picture from just watching what happens. You can see heart beating normally. Normally a heart is about a fist-sized organ. Kind of weird here, they cut off the blood vessel, didn't they? So, you know, in terms of cardiac failure or heart failure, this is not something you wake up with tomorrow and say, boy, I've got heart failure. This is something that is a progressive disease that can occur over a number of years. And what they're showing here is, you know, the kidneys release a chemical called EPO. What does EPO do? Yeah, more red blood cells. That will increase your blood volume. And you'll notice that in response to that increased blood volume, the heart is having to beat faster in order to circulate that blood. And so you might notice that the muscle thickened on that picture, and unfortunately the heart becomes a bigger, flabbier pump when that happens.
So the treatment for that is heart
transplant? Ultimately, yeah. I mean, what they may do short term is something like a beta blocker. They may give a ACE inhibitor, and then, yeah, if that eventually becomes too much for the heart, then it, yeah, transplant is the next step. So,
with some kind of exercise?
Earlier in life, yeah, exercise, watching your diet, getting regular health checkups, doing blood pressure checkups, because it's a progressive thing that, you know, 1 year you may have 120 over 80, the next year it may be 125. So if it sneaks up progressively, then that's what they want to stop before it gets to be a chronic condition like this. Yes, so there you've got that enlarged heart. Yeah, it does look like it's drooping down. Yeah. And yeah, being, like you say,
the muscle is getting heavier, like pulling, you know, because the bigger part is at the bottom of the heart anyway.
And your gravity pulls it down.
What about medication that increases blood pressure? Like, would that, could that cause your heart to do that?
Medications, and probably, you know. What's that? Yeah. Especially if somebody over takes a particular medication, it may not be a problem in normal doses, but in excess, it could lead to this. Yeah. So heart failure may start as a particular side being affected first, and then it may progress to both sides being affected. This is a trick. Watch what we're doing. If your left side heart fails, your left ventricle is the major pumping chamber. And if it fails as a pump, it's no longer able to eject the blood out into circulation. Normally, the left ventricle sends blood to what large artery?
The aorta.
Okay. And if it's a big, flabby, weak muscle, instead of giving a good hard squeeze to eject blood through the aorta, it's not able to fully do so. So blood actually backflows. Go backwards with me. From the left ventricle, we back up through the bicuspid valve into the
left atrium.
What veins don't blood into the left atrium?
The pulmonary veins.
Here we go. We're going to back up blood into both of those lungs. And here's the symptoms. Congestion, pulmonary edema, fluid around the lungs, not able to breathe, shortness of breath. These kinds of things come from having the left side of the heart fail as a pump. So we just got to keep in mind that we're backflowing.
So are those signs immediate, like those symptoms immediate, or is that something that, I mean, does it happen all at once? Or?
I would say it probably progressively gets worse.
Right.
So it's not like you're going to have all of these at one point. You're going to progressively pick them up, and they'll continue to worsen. Let's see, if you've got a right side heart failure issue, then of course the right side normally injects blood through the pulmonary trunk, but back it up. If you backflow it due to a weak right ventricle, you send it into the tricuspid valve and then back into
the right atrium.
And because of gravity, which vena cava do you actually pull that blood down into?
Inferior, yeah.
So you'll notice a lot of these symptoms here are peripheral in nature. That means swollen hands and feet. You know, the socks cut into the ankles. Rings can't come off the hands. What's that? Yeah, poor circulation, yes. So the right side tends to have more of these systemic kinds of symptoms, where the left side tends to drive more of those pulmonary symptoms. Both of these conditions, though, cause something called ascites. And you may notice it in this picture and in the previous picture, it's a big swollen belly. And that comes from the heart being unable to pump off the fluid. And so the fluid tends to backflow and accumulate around the belly. So, you know, we may think that somebody has a beer belly or a big gut, when in fact it may be a fluid belly. So unfortunately, with both of these conditions, what may start as being a single-sided failure will ultimately progress to what? Both sides, yeah. So what is happening is, you know, the heart tries to accommodate and one side may begin to fail and the other side says, to heck with this, I can't keep up. And so both sides become a less efficient pump.
They're like pretty much internally self-fighting.
Pretty much, yeah. But, you know, they will try treatments before they get to the point of a heart transplant. But, yeah, you start filling up with fluid.
Question. If undetected, could anything possibly set it off to be fatal quicker?
I'm sure lifestyle could do it. You know, smoking, things like that. Things that would exacerbate the high blood pressure issue could probably make this progress a little more quickly.
What about any major surgeries? Like if it goes undetected and they don't know. Maybe like any major surgeries, like maybe the GI age or, I mean, GI area.
You know, if they're not aware, they would probably be aware of this being an underlying issue due to the high blood pressure. So if they're going to send somebody into like a major surgery, then they may detect this as they're prepping that person for surgery, you know, in the weeks coming up to that surgery. So they may realize that there's underlying issues going on. Is that kind of what you're asking?
They didn't find out till it was too late.
Till after the fact. Wow. Yeah, this is kind of an unfortunate thing because it's not something that's always obvious, and it's something that somebody may not realize they have until they start having actual debilitating symptoms from. Yeah. Let's see. Let's talk about some heart conditions you're probably familiar with having heard about. Myocardial infarction and angina are over on the next page. The difference between these two is time and how much damage is done to the heart muscle tissue. We know oxygen is required for muscle tissue to make ATP. If the lack of oxygen is short-term, we call it angina. But if we're looking at a long-term lack of oxygen and damage to that muscle tissue, now we call it a heart attack. And so a heart attack is also known as an MI or myocardial infarct or infarction. So of course they say any chest pain should be checked. You know, if you have angina, you may have chest pain with exercise, climbing stairs, things of that sort. You know, if you're checked and they say it's okay, it's just, you know, temporary lack of oxygen, then at least you know you've been checked and everything's okay. But we often don't know if those are the warning signs that go along with heart attack or something worse that's looming on the horizon. Y'all still need the slide. Okay. So this slide comes from the CDC. This is the Center for Disease Control. And they advertise classic signs and symptoms of heart attack. So we know that, you know, chest pain, crushing chest pain is a sign of a heart attack. What are some other things to look for? Pain in the left arm. Pain in the left arm. Jaw pain, yeah. Back pain, yeah, right through the back side where your heart is located. Good. Sweating, fast heart rate, nausea, clamminess. Okay, so just going back to that left arm issue, of course, there's no heart on the left arm, there's no heart in the left jaw area, but that's all referred pain. Good. Let's see, I do want to mention women's symptoms. It's maybe a little bit small to read. I had a student in class in her 50s. I think she took the class, this Bio 211, about 2 years ago during a summer semester. And she had a rolling book bag, and she said that when she rolled her book bag across this third floor walkway out here, that she was out of breath, and she had bits of chest pain. And just so happened, we talked about women's symptoms for heart attack as being different from men's. And oftentimes, women don't necessarily have all the classic men symptoms like left arm pain. Women may feel different. They may feel more exhausted than they ever have. And women will oftentimes say, it's okay, so-and-so at work was sick, and I'm probably coming down with what they have, and it's okay, I'll get over it. And they don't necessarily connect the symptoms as being heart attack, because what do we say? You know, heart attack is left arm pain and all this other stuff. Well, this particular student was scared enough by our conversation, thankfully for her. She went and had herself checked at her cardiologist's office, and she disappeared from my class. I got an email a few weeks later. She had had open heart surgery. Wow. Yeah, she had a, if I remember correctly, a three-way bypass. And so that walking across this third floor walkway and being somewhat out of breath was her warning. That was it. Yeah.
So that prevented any kind of like scar tissue?
That's right. Wow. That's right. She was out that summer, that fall semester. She came back, and I believe it was last spring, 2016, she was in my class. And she cried during class talking about that, because she said, you know, if it had not been for being alert of those symptoms, then she could have possibly died from having had a heart attack. So, you know, I feel very compelled to share her story, because, you know, she certainly was very thankful for having been aware of what was going on with her body and went to get checked. So if you know a woman in your life that has symptoms that, you know, exhaustion, pain in the chest, maybe just a heavy chest feeling, not necessarily the crushing chest feeling. This also says shortness of breath, nausea, lightheadedness, dizziness, unusual fatigue, and breaking out in a cold sweat. So those are some things to look for women's symptoms. Okay. And there's actually a website, womenshealth.gov, and they actually have things geared toward what women experience versus what men experience, which is kind of interesting to notice.
Is
that
heart disease more common than women?
It's, I think, one of the leading causes of death in women. I don't know that it's more common. I think men are more at risk for dying from it than women are. All right, so I'm going to let you guys read the rest of that page. It just talks about treatment and diagnosis using some kinds of enzymes in the bloodstream. So I'll let you read through that. And then we've got a few practice pages here in the remainder of this chapter. How about questions so far? So I think it's great that we're going to be doing the next test on two chapters that marry up really nicely. You've got heart and blood vessels, two parts of the cardiovascular system. So I'd like to start by introducing you to just generic blood vessel anatomy. So let me take you over to page 51. At the top, we're going to talk about general blood vessel anatomy. All right, first term there, tunica. What is a tunic? Tunic is a layer. Okay. So you've got a tunica intima, tunica media, and a tunica adventitia, or you can also call it tunica externa. But tunics are layers. And the terms, of course, kind of give you an idea of where they're located. Intima is the innermost lining. It's made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. That's not terribly exciting, is it? Okay, what is exciting is in the middle layer. The tunica media is mostly muscle tissue, Autonomic nervous system has nerves that innervate that tunica media. We also see some collagen fibers in there. So that is the exciting portion of your blood vessel, and it is the region that can constrict your vessel or relax your vessel. So first thing to gather from this chapter is that any time you vasoconstrict or squeeze a vessel, what happens to your blood pressure? Goes up. And if you have trouble remembering that, just remember when you're up tight and, you know, your vessels squeeze, your blood pressure is going up. So if you're stressed out, if you're on epinephrine, you know, those kinds of things will increase blood pressure. When you're relaxed, your vessels relax, the diameter increases, and what happens to pressure?
It decreases.
It decreases, right. All right, so we've got intima inside, media, the middle layer. The outside is externa or adventitia. And what's found in that outermost layer? Collagen fibers, good. Why are they there? Yeah, because if your vessel's going to pulsate with the blood flow traveling through, you don't want it to pulsate so greatly that it stretches and tears the vessel open. Those collagen fibers are like steel cables that wrap the outside and kind of give your vessel some structure. That way we maintain the diameter of your vessel. So, of course, over time, over 80 years of a lifetime, those collagen fibers wear out. And then, of course, people have blood pressure issues the older they get. So it's just the nature of the beast of aging that we're all going to have blood pressure conditions from those less strong collagen fibers. So you probably know a good bit about these arteries. They are typically colored red on your models in lab because they carry blood away from the heart. And that's just their way of denoting that they are oxygenated in nature. So almost all of our arteries carry blood away. Almost all of our arteries are colored red. We know there's an exception of two. There's, of course, in the heart. Which pulmon? Oh, I gave it to you. Don't you wish I'd do that on test day, right?
Yeah.
Pulmonary arteries, they're what color?
Blue.
And why?
Because they carry deoxygenated.
Deoxygenated, good. Okay. Let's see, I do want to make the point that an artery operates under higher pressure than a vein, and for that reason, it needs a thicker tunica media. So if you take a look at this vessel, you'll notice inside lining is tunica interna, and this is a rather thick layer of media, and then there's the externa on the outside. All right, so some of our arteries are classified as elastic. Some are classified as muscular. You could just stop right there and not read any more and probably tell me what this slide says. What does elastic say to you?
Stretchy.
Stretchy. And muscular arteries aren't necessarily stretchy. What can they do? They contract, right. So if you need the stretchiness in those elastic arteries, it's because you're conducting high blood pressure and you're looking at vessels that are closest to the heart. The aorta, the pulmonary trunk, the common carotids, all of these experience great deals of pressure and have to be stretchy to accommodate that high pressure. By contrast, you're right, those muscular arteries contract. So if you want to increase blood pressure in a muscular artery, should it contract or should it relax?
Contract,
right. And of course, if it relaxes, then the vessel opens up greater diameter and blood pressure decreases. These are going to be used as our pulse points in our body, and they're typically named for the location. That's a fairly general rule. And you'll notice some examples there. Femoral artery is named for its location in the femur. Radial artery is named for its location. Just checking to see if you need the slide. Going once, going twice. Y'all good? Okay. So speaking of pulse points, I did want to mention that, you know, you probably already know this, but your thumb has its own pulse, right? Okay, so if you're taking the pulse, say, through the wrist or in any other number of locations, we want to avoid using that thumb. So let's just start and work our way from the head down. Where in the head can we take the pulse? Carotid, temporal. Let's see, how about in the arm areas? Brachial, and here, radial. Good, in the wrist. And how about the armpit? Axillary, good. Let's go down to the legs. Femoral, good, right up here at the legs. Where else? Pedal, good, at the foot. Popliteal, behind the knee. And interestingly, you can actually take the pulse right at the apex of the heart. It's called an apical pulse. So you've got a lot of good places there to pick from. Yeah, kind of have to squeeze in there, right? So you can use two fingers, and if you've got a good strong pulse, you can be able to tell the pulse from just those two fingers. Now, I've told you guys I'm on a beta blocker, and when I first started detecting my pulse on the beta blocker, I couldn't feel my heartbeat. So there is a three-finger trick that you can use. If you use the three-finger trick, then what you do is use your ring finger to cut off the blood supply. You push down on the vessel with that finger, and then you gently use your first two fingers to lay across that vessel, and then you should start to feel a heartbeat. So that may work for you if you have somebody who has a hard-to-detect pulse. All right, so here's an elastic artery. I think you can see the squiggly elastic fibers in there. Great for stretchiness. Can you, go ahead. It is so pretty, all colored with reds and pinks. And can you tell me an example of where we have one of these?
Aorta.
Good. All right. Muscular arteries have less elastic fibers. It is not their job to be stretchy. Rather, it is their job to do what? Contract, right. So if you need to increase blood to a certain area and increase the pressure, they contract, and that helps us to maintain blood flow to the rest of the body. So over time, if you have high blood pressure, you can overstretch those elastic arteries. So just like, you know, underwear, I'm always talking about underwear in here. So if you've got underwear that's, you know, seen its day and it's not going to recoil back to its original shape, you know it's lost its elasticity. Same thing with these blood vessels. High blood pressure can stretch out those elastic fibers, and that vessel should recoil back to its original shape. But unfortunately, you know, if you've got high blood pressure for many years, it just stays stretched. My dad had an aortic aneurysm down in the abdomen, and he went into the hospital because he kept vomiting and wouldn't stop. And so as a precaution, they did a scan to see what was going on in his abdomen, you know, expecting to find something going on with his digestive tract, when in fact they saw an aortic aneurysm that was 3 times the normal width of your aorta. So normal aorta is about this wide. Yeah, it's a pretty large vessel. And his had been stretched out from high blood pressure. He was a smoker, to about this wide. So about, I think it was almost 7.5 or 8 centimeters or so that his aorta had stretched. And that's due to high blood pressure. So it can stretch your iliacs, it can stretch your aorta, and it can cause aneurysms. And in 5 minutes, if that thing ruptures, you're gone. So that's kind of, you know, something scary to think about with those elastic arteries.
What causes like spider veins?
Pressure changes, like they're capillaries basically that aren't getting the blood flow like they're supposed to. So it's like a capillary that's not fed into the system, oftentimes on legs due to pregnancy, due to overweight or lifting at work.
So those are just capillaries?
To my understanding, they're capillaries. Varicose veins, though, were something different because those are actual veins that have had failures.
Okay.
Yep. We know that veins on average carry blood back to the heart. That's most of the time. Most of the time they're also colored blue because what type of blood do they carry?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, and of course we know the pulmonary veins are red because they actually carry oxygenated blood. Well, here's the deal. Your veins are known as blood reservoirs. It's something like 60% of your blood at any given time is found in your veins. And so your veins are low pressured. They have thin walls. They don't have muscular layers in that tunica media that really do a great job in helping get that blood back to your heart. So we need some things to help us out. Because gravity helps to pull the blood down to your feet, we need to make sure that that blood maintains its flow back to the heart for oxygenation. So in the heart, what do valves prevent from happening?
Backflow.
Same thing here. Yeah, so valves in your veins prevent backflow. In fact, skeletal muscle activity will help to increase blood flow through your veins. It will squeeze against the walls of your veins and ensure that blood does not go back. Because if the valve closes, you're not going to backflow that blood. I know you've probably heard about don't stand and lock your legs, right?
Pass out,
yeah, because that's because 60% of your blood sits in your veins. If you lock your legs, you're locking blood from getting back to the heart and, of course, to the brain. That's right, not cross your legs, not cross your ankles. Yeah. Not with these discs, you can't.
No, and this ain't got to be.
Especially those, yeah, that you're sitting in. See, they're helping your health, right? Keep you from crossing those legs.
Can't do it in an open space, honestly. I have that issue all the time, especially when I wear skirts and stuff. I like to wear it because I like to be free.
Right.
Everybody getting that. Everybody's like, close your legs. I'm like, now I'm going to say, well, I'll die if I do close.
I'll bottom out my blood pressure and that's it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I have an excuse.
I wanted to show you varicose veins. You know, we've probably all seen somebody or unfortunately experienced them ourselves, but varicose veins come from valve failures. And you'll notice that the blood pops in those varicose veins. So here's a picture of them before and after surgery. What they can do is fill that vessel with saline and kind of like cements it shut. It's kind of a gross concept, but it works and it prevents from having pain in those varicose veins. Pregnancy, weight, and doing heavy lifting at work can also cause varicose veins.
Oh, so that's what they do to the umbilical cord when the babies go back and he has a draw all the way in. They put that silicone twisted in there to draw it up.
Oh, like to seal it off and stop the bleeding, yeah. And I did want to mention, you know, we've probably seen people in hospital situations wearing these pneumatic boots. The whole goal there is to act as the skeletal muscle pump to help return blood back to the heart, and that way we don't form what in those veins?
Blood clots.
Blood clots, exactly. To wear or to put on?
To wear.
I imagine. Squeeze and relax and squeeze, yeah.
Oh my God. It's usually like
somebody giving your legs a massage.
No, it doesn't feel like a massage.
I imagine not, no.
It is horrible. Yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
Especially when you're in the hospital and it goes off every like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
No, you can't sleep or anything if that's, yeah.
I forgot what happened. I forgot for which surgery it was, but they put that thing on.
But they put it on.
And I threatened a nurse. So it's like, if you die,
you have to take
this off.
If it squeezes as hard as a blood pressure cuff, that's got to be awful. So if you've ever been really stressed out, I'm sure somebody has said to you, take a deep breath and relax, which just makes you madder, right? But if you listen and you breathe deeply, then that makes the blood pressure lower in your chest. And it does help, yeah. It makes your blood pressure lower. It returns blood back to your heart, and then it gets it back to your brain. So these are three things that your body can do to help assist blood flow back to the heart because those veins operate under such low pressure. Okay, so I did want to mention that varicose veins cannot be just in the legs, it can also be hemorrhoids as well. So these are failed valves. And so just for comparison's sake, you can see arteries have a much thicker tunica media. Veins have a thinner one. Why the difference? Yeah, contraction, high pressure, of course, in arteries, veins have pretty much zero pressure and therefore don't need quite as thick of a tunica media. Good. Tiny arteries are called arterioles and tiny veins are called venules. And you'll notice their walls are really small and the amount of blood they transport is also less. And that takes us to capillaries. Did you get your blank at the very bottom? Okay. Capillaries are made up of only tunica intima. Top of your next page. Capillaries are made only of tunica intima. They are an ideal location for us to do exchanges such as fluid exchange, gas exchange, nutrient exchange, because of that single layer of cells. That's all we've got to deal with, is that one layer of cells. This is a really cool picture. You've got a set of blood cells traveling through single file. This is why red blood cells need to be flexible, because some capillaries are so small that they have to flex in, bend over on themselves, and then return back to their normal state when they emerge. Most of our cells and tissues are pretty close to a set of capillaries. There's a few that are avascular. We know that epithelial tissues, avascular, cartilage, things like that. But most blood is going to be traveling close to keep those tissues alive. So even if there's not a direct supply, we still send nourishment by way of diffusion to those cells and tissues. Some of our capillaries are continuous. Some of our capillaries are fenestrated. And what we mean by a continuous capillary is one that is closed off to the environment that it passes through. All right, so in this case, a set of closed capillaries has tight junctions between those squamous cells, and we really can limit what passes through to the surrounding cells and tissues. Thinking back to Bio-210, what set of capillaries or blood flow does this sound like? Where do you have some capillaries where you don't want a lot of interchange with the environment? Blood-brain barrier. Bingo, blood-brain barrier. Good. So that's a great location for a set of closed or continuous capillaries. There's not a great deal of exchange that goes on through those. Instead of exchanging through the blood-brain barrier, we actually exchange our nutrients and waste products more through that cerebrospinal fluid. Let's see, the liver, the spleen are two good locations as examples for fenestrated capillaries. These are capillaries that have pores or openings. What does the spleen do for worn out blood cells? Yeah, removes and recycles. So you need to have the fenestrations there to get those worn out cells from the capillary.
Go back to that last slide one more time.
Sure. Anybody still need this slide? Okay. So I don't want us to get the idea that capillaries are just a single vessel connecting an arteriole and a venule. They're in fact more like a network or a bed of vessels connecting arterioles and venules. So in reality, this is what we expect to see is a capillary bed, which is a network. And these capillary beds can be regulated by sphincters. So what is a sphincter?
Like a valve.
Like a valve. Yeah. Closes and opens. Good. So in this picture, you can see how those sphincters can either open and let blood flow through the capillary bed or close and prevent the blood flow through. Thinking back to Bio-210, what happens to capillary beds when you're cold? Close them up, yeah, constrict the vessels, prevent the blood flow like in the bottom picture here. But if you're warm, then open up the sphincters like the top picture and let the blood flow through. And that way you can radiate off some of that extra heat. Okie doke. So that takes you about halfway down your page. What I did for you in the middle of this page is summarize systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation. Those tie into what we covered back on page 38. Now we appreciate that arteries branch into smaller vessels called arterioles. They feed into capillary beds. Capillary beds drain into venules like we see here. Venules carry us to what? Veins, good. So that's just the flow pattern we want to now appreciate. Let's see, during the last few minutes of class today, I'd like to introduce you to blood pressure down near the bottom of the page. So blood pressure is a force created by the water or plasma in your blood. Okay, keywords here. This is the force of plasma, which is the water in your blood, and it pushes against the walls of your vessels. Yeah, it's up there. I can repeat it for you though if you need. Okay, so we know that blood pressure is measured in millimeters mercury. That unit is mmHg. And the heart beating and pushing that blood is what creates the current that flows throughout our vessels and nourishes our bodies with oxygen and nutrients. Okay, so just something to appreciate. When we talked about blood, on average, how much of your blood volume is plasma? Somewhere about 55%, okay? And then about 1% is buffy coat, and about 44% then is going to be red blood cells, good. So the ratio that I'm trying to make a point here is that we have more liquid in our blood and less cells to circulate, and as long as we've got that ratio, then things work okay. When we start altering that ratio, having too much fluid, not enough fluid and too many cells, then we start seeing a change in blood pressure, okay? Anybody still need the slide? Oh, good. Okay, on the top of your next page is this picture, but I do want to keep you on the bottom of the current page. This picture is a graph showing blood pressure and mean arterial pressure in the vessels. Let me start you off with the aorta. The aorta and, of course, the major arteries around the heart carry blood under the highest pressure. If you're looking at the mean arterial pressure, this line right here through the middle, we have the highest mean arterial pressure sitting here in your aorta. I don't know if I have any napkins. Let me see. I have toilet paper with that. So the highest mean arterial pressure is in your aorta. You'll notice that we see a decline most steeply in your arterioles. What happens to the diameter of an arteriole?
Narrower.
Narrower, yeah. So as you get into a narrower passageway, you'll notice the pressure is going to drop off. So that is where we see the steepest decline in blood pressure, is in those arterioles. Well, we've already done the damage to the blood pressure. Once you get into capillaries, which are even smaller, blood pressure continues to fall off. And by the time you reach your venules and veins, you'll eventually reach a blood pressure of 0 mmHg. That's why we need all that help getting the blood flow back to the heart. So let me go to the blanks in the bottom of your page. The highest blood pressure is experienced in which vessel?
Aorta.
Aorta, good. And the steepest drop?
Arterioles,
good.
So we don't need to put the elastic arteries and the cholesterol in?
Yeah, don't need to worry about those, yeah. Just aorta and arterioles for those two. Okay, anybody still, you don't need this slide, do you? You got this picture in your course pack. Okay. We've talked about this before. I just wanted to reintroduce it since we're talking about blood pressure. This was actually pictured back several pages, but, you know, the American Heart Association right now is saying that normal is 80 to 120, 60 to 80 is good for diastolic. But we're going to keep this in mind as being a guide for what normal blood pressure should be. It could, yeah, diet and exercise could help, and it could be hereditary too.
If it's hereditary, could it still be hereditary with exercise and diet? Or is there just like, if it's hereditary, it's hereditary?
You can probably counteract it for a certain period of time, and at some point it may be more than the diet and exercise can handle, and then medication may be necessary.
Like, my husband's mom and his aunt have high blood pressure, and his blood pressure.
So he's kind of pushing in that neighborhood, yeah. And maybe, right now it may be a function of age, and then when he hits a certain age, it may be more than he can do through diet and exercise. And at that point, they may say, well, we can't do anything else, you know, they'll try medication maybe at that point. Yeah. Which has its cons, you know. Yeah. Right, right. And then heart damage and all that other stuff, yeah. Okay, just kind of taking you back for a moment, when we talked in the last chapter about cardiac output, we know it depends on two variables, heart rate and stroke volume. We know that these are all directly proportioned. That means that if heart rate goes up, what happens to cardiac output?
It goes up.
It goes up, yeah. If stroke volume goes up, cardiac output goes up. Good, so they're all related. If one goes up, they all go up. If one goes down, they all go down. So I want to remind you of cardiac output because it does influence greatly our blood pressure. In fact, you may want to put a star beside it, circle it, highlight it. Cardiac output is the number one determinant for blood pressure. Cardiac output is the number one determinant for blood pressure. That's why for those with chronic heart failure, we may simply say, okay, you're on Lasix, we're going to pull some of that blood volume down, and that will decrease blood pressure. So if you've got somebody who's, say, experiencing low blood pressure, increasing blood volume is also going to help increase pressure. PR stands for peripheral resistance, not Puerto Rico. Poor Puerto Rico. Yeah.
They got like 3 feet
apart. Oh, yeah, and I think they said more was to come.
Yeah, and the whole island's like on power.
Yeah.
And we got it for like 4 weeks.
Yeah, they said it'd be a while because the power grid was killed. And, wow.
But they really have a good
ability. Yeah, and everybody else is destroyed and they're next to them, yeah. Awful.
What did you say PR was?
PR is peripheral resistance. So peripheral resistance is anything that resists blood flow. I know that's kind of defining the term with its own meaning there. But peripheral resistance is going to slow down blood flow through the vessels. And there's three things that we're going to look at probably in here on Tuesday that influence blood flow. I highly recommend reading ahead in both the textbook and the course pack about blood pressure regulation. In your course pack, it starts on page 54. There's practice we'll do together on 55. We'll hit that on Tuesday, but if you've read ahead, it'll greatly help your understanding. Y'all have a great weekend.